Yesterday in the talk, Gil brought in this teaching from the suttas. On the 17 defilements. And this teaching in its context to me kind of speaks to the interwoven nature or the spiraling nature of these five faculties that we're exploring this week. Because in the sutta, it points to these imperfections that defile the mind and says, knowing them, knowing that unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, one abandons it. Goes through all 17 in that way. Knowing that it is an imperfection that defiles the mind, one abandons it. When one has known and has abandoned, one acquires unwavering confidence, the faith that Gil was speaking about yesterday. And so that unwavering confidence, I would say, that's the full maturation of confidence. That's the confidence that when confidence and faith in that way are really full, strong, we have essentially the verified understanding of the teachings of the Buddha. We have that for ourselves. We know it. We feel it. We understand it. That really kind of spurs the energy on to continue the practice. And yet, how do we begin the practice? So even before that unwavering confidence, this whole practice, this whole process that's kind of described here, knowing these defilements, one abandons them. To me, that kind of encapsulates so much of what we do on retreat. Just that phrase. And in order to even do that, we need some measure of a sense of why we might do this, a sense of the value of the practice, a sense of confidence in the practice. And so this action, this engagement with knowing the defilements takes energy. And so it takes, there's a little bit of faith, perhaps a little bit of sense of understanding the value of doing this, which spurs us on to engage, which leads to some understanding through energy, mindfulness, concentration, connecting with experience. Wisdom arises, understanding, the understanding arises that allows the abandoning. In my sense of this teaching, really, the abandoning isn't something that we do. It's a result of understanding. And so it's the result of the arising of wisdom, that faculty of wisdom. And that arising of that wisdom then creates that sense of, I understand this now. This is the value of the practice. We deeply understand it for ourselves, and so faith is strengthened more. So it's like we go through this process in many loops, many, many weavings. A little bit of faith leads to a little bit of energy, mindfulness, concentration, and some wisdom arises, and that spurs on more energy. So today, I'd like to explore in a little more depth this factor of energy, the faculty of energy, and how it fits into the picture. But again, recognizing that even though we're talking about them one at a time, and there is a support from one to the next, that faith does inspire energy. It's not that faith happens and then energy happens and then mindfulness happens. They all work together. And so in describing how energy works, I'll be describing how we explore things with mindfulness and concentration, and that wisdom arises with that. So we can't really speak of them independently. They all are interwoven. They all interconnect. And yet we can speak about them as qualities of mind. They're qualities of heart and mind that support our practice. And so the faculty of energy is a faculty of, sometimes it's translated as a kind of a courage or a strength. Energy itself is a neutral quality of mind. Energy can motivate anger, and energy can motivate love, mindfulness, concentration. And so it really matters how we cultivate energy, where we direct that sense of engagement, how we want to engage. It matters how we do that, what we aim our energy to. How are we using our energy? Are we using it to continue fantasizing and getting frustrated, or are we using it to cultivate more understanding? So the teachings offered by the Buddha offer us some guidance on skillful ways to direct our energy, to apply our energy. One of the key teachings around this is to cultivate skillful qualities of mind, qualities of mind that support moving in the direction of happiness, of ease, of peace, and to let go of, avoid unskillful qualities of mind. Those qualities of mind that create tension, constriction, those qualities of those defilements, those 17 defilements are key, you know, examples of those unskillful qualities of mind. And as Gil mentioned yesterday, they're basically those qualities of mind rooted in greed, wanting to have something, to hold on to something, aversion, wanting to get rid of something, and delusion. A view or a perspective that, I guess we can really say that delusion underlies both greed and aversion, because the greed itself is that wanting, that sense of the pull towards something. And the delusion that underlies it is the belief that having it will make me happy. And happy, the belief is generally, you know, the belief is that it will make me happy forever. I mean, even if we don't believe that consciously, that's how greed is working. If I get that thing, that'll be it. And we can actually see this sometimes. You know, I was kind of surprised at one point. I was checking into the greed around wanting some chocolate. And, you know, in that moment of that wanting, the belief in there was like, yeah, that is gonna, that's gonna do it for me. It's kind of shocking, you know, because I know intellectually chocolate doesn't last very long. But, you know, wanting doesn't think that way. And so the delusion underlying wanting is really that sense of it's going to do it for me. And the delusion underlying aversion is that, yeah, getting rid of that is going to make me happy. That's how I'll be in control. That's how I'll figure things out. And so these three fundamental qualities, greed, aversion, and delusion, underlie our suffering, the way we struggle, how we get tied up in knots. And so the encouragement in practice is to understand those states of mind, as the sutta that Gil shared pointed to. Understand, knowing these states of mind are defilement. We know that they are suffering. This is really very similar to what the teaching of the First Noble Truth. There is suffering. This is suffering. Whatever, you know, we're experiencing arising of some of an experience of a state based in greed, aversion, and delusion, and the recognition this is suffering. That's understanding it in a different way. So the wisdom that the Buddha points to is one of the aspects of wisdom is this very simple understanding around what's helpful for leading our heart to more ease and peace, and what's not helpful. And to cultivate what's helpful and to let go of what's not helpful. This is a simple way to describe one of the key teachings of the Buddha. And the faculty of energy is connected with this exploration. We use our energy to explore what's skillful, what's unskillful, to get to know it, to understand what's unskillful as unskillful, to get to understand what's skillful as skillful. So wisdom is a key support for cultivating our energy in a skillful way. There's some other supports for energy. There are ways to look at it, and I think about this the factor of energy or effort. They're very closely related, energy and effort. Are in many of the lists that the Buddha taught. And many of those lists can be understood as a little bit sequential in a way, often one supporting the cultivation of the next. And in one of the lists, the list of the 10 paramis, which is a list of 10 qualities that the Buddha before he was the Buddha is said to have cultivated in many lifetimes. The quality that precedes energy in that list is wisdom. Wisdom, that direction, the wisdom needs to support the direction of the energy. In the five faculties, faith supports energy. And so that sense of confidence in the possibility, that sense that this is possible when we have a sense of a direction, a teaching perhaps that says something that our heart aspires to, a possibility of ease and peace, freedom from all of the constrictures of the heart, that's possible. We hear that that's possible. And not only that, that there's a way to do it. And that's what's great about the Buddha's teachings. He not only says it's possible, he says, here, do these things. This will get you there. And he says, you know, you have to do it. I can't make it happen for you. You have to do it. You have to walk the path. But hearing that and having that sense of possibility can inspire us to actually begin, to begin that engagement. So that's energy. The energy towards acting in the direction of that aim. So faith or confidence is a support for energy. In the list of the seven factors of awakening, we have mindfulness at the head of the list and investigation as the second quality of that. So, you know, the mindfulness, the meeting experience, getting familiar with experience and being curious about it, exploring, meeting the experience. The next one is energy. And so mindfulness and investigation also support energy. And it's interesting to me that in the faculties, it's reversed. So energy supports mindfulness in the faculties. So this really, again, points to the interweaving of all of these. We can't really pull them apart and say, okay, first I'm going to cultivate energy, then I'll cultivate mindfulness. Or, oh, the seven factors says I should cultivate mindfulness first. Well, if you don't have energy, you're not going to do that either. So there's just this blending and interweaving of all of these. And then there's the teaching on wise effort in the Eightfold Path. It's a different word from energy. The Pali word for energy is virya, which does often have a sense of kind of robustness or strength, courage to it. And then effort in the Eightfold Path, wise effort, samavayama. Sama meaning wise or right, and vayama meaning effort. And there's an interesting interrelationship between these two, because in order to make effort, we need some energy. So there's some level of, you know, if we had no energy, we'd just be like a puddle on the ground and not able to take action. So there's some energy that needs to be available to step into the wise effort, step into the actions there, the encouragement there, the exploration for wise effort. So some energy is needed to make effort. And I think we can see this in our everyday lives. You know, it's like we have to get up and get out of bed in order to start making our breakfast, right? I mean, we need some energy in order to do things. So there's a little bit of energy that's needed to make effort. But the interesting teaching in this around what the result of wise effort is. The very definition of the faculty of energy is the energy one obtains having engaged in the four wise efforts. So energy results from making wise effort. That's actually a great thing. Like, we need a little bit of energy to get going, but if we use that energy wisely, skillfully, we get more energy. So the energy that is results having engaged with the four wise efforts, this is the energy that we're speaking of here. And so looking at how to cultivate our effort is another support for this energy. It is a key support for this energy. And it's no surprise, actually, that the definition of wise effort comes back to wisdom around what is skillful and unskillful. Right back to that wisdom of cultivating the wholesome and letting go of the unwholesome. So the teaching on the four wise efforts. Four kinds of effort that embeds wisdom right in the definition. And so the way we make the effort is aimed in the direction of what we want to accomplish. So these four wise efforts: avoiding unwholesome states that have not arisen, abandoning unwholesome states that have arisen, cultivating wholesome states that have not arisen, and maintaining wholesome states that have arisen. So again, the effort towards this understanding, first of all, an understanding around what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. And first we have to take that as a teaching, kind of to begin to just understand the definition of wholesome and unwholesome, where the wholesome qualities are those not based in greed, aversion, and delusion, and the unwholesome qualities are those that are tied up with greed, aversion, and delusion. We begin to feel, as we begin to investigate this in our experience, because this is an experiential encouragement here, this effort, to begin to be curious about what is the experience of what's going on in our hearts and minds. And I think, you know, we can begin to feel into the unwholesome and feel it as unwholesome because when we are aware, mindful of greed, anger, irritation, shall I read the list again? When we know those internally, when we feel them, we know they are suffering. We feel it. I kind of said the other day that it was a shock to me when I really turned towards that experience of anger and knew it. Oh, this is suffering. The mind had, you know, kind of skipped over that part and focused on this idea that it was going to make somebody else miserable. But when I really looked at it, it's like, wow, this is making me miserable way before. I mean, the other person doesn't even know I'm angry. But I'm feeling this suffering. And so the turning towards the being aware of, the cultivation of being mindful of all of those difficult, unwholesome states will point out to us that they are suffering. So that's really what the teaching said. Knowing that ill will is an imperfection that defiles the mind. So before I turned to look at anger, I didn't know it was creating so much pain internally. I didn't know it was a stain on the mind. Somehow thought it was helping me. And so the knowing it was the beginning of the abandoning, the beginning process of that. And so we first have to get a little bit of an understanding of what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. And then observing experience, we begin to feel it ourselves, what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. When we feel into the wholesome qualities, when we feel into metta, love, for instance, we feel the unconstricted nature of that. Our heart does not feel tight. And there's a kind of an expansive quality. There's a sense of connectedness and care. The mind understands what's wholesome and unwholesome if we give ourselves a chance to look at our experience. And so the Buddha describing what's wholesome and what's unwholesome, what's helpful and unhelpful, isn't just a list he made up. It was looking in his own experience and feeling into, that way lies suffering. This way lies ease, freedom, and peace. And so it's a reflection of, this teaching is a reflection of experience. And at first we just have to take it in and begin by being curious, like, you know, the first time somebody ever told me through a book, why don't you try looking at your anger? It's like, oh, I don't see how that's going to help anything. Why bother? But then trying it and beginning to understand makes all the difference. So the four wise efforts. The effort towards the non-arising of unwholesome states that have not arisen. That's a mouthful. We could say the effort towards the avoiding of unwholesome states that have not arisen. So what does this mean in practice? I'd say that, you know, one of the key things that we're all doing here that is in support of this is following the precepts. That engagement, that effort to avoid those unwholesome actions. When we avoid taking life, avoid taking what's not given, we refrain from causing harm through our sexual actions. We refrain from false speech. All of those refraining from unwholesome actions supports us from not having the follow-on unwholesome mind states that follow on when we engage in those actions. And so you're all doing that. You're all engaging in that already. The interesting thing about the non-arising is often we are experiencing it and we don't notice it. So it's useful to actually recognize, just, you know, maybe sometime during the day, you know, you could be anywhere, you could be having a cup of tea, and just check in, you know, how are things right now, you know? And maybe there's not aversion happening. Aversion is not arising, perhaps. So this recognition of the absence of can be very supportive. And we don't often notice what's not here. So this non-arising piece is, sometimes it's not so easy to notice. But you might also notice at times, like, and this often happens on retreat, where as the retreat goes on, we see our minds get much more flexible, more easeful. And we find, you know, something happens, for instance, you know, first few days of retreat, perhaps we're very sensitive to things other yogis are doing and having aversion arise around things. And so we're noticing the arising of that. But as the retreat goes on, you might start noticing that your mind is not engaging in reacting in the way that it had. This is useful to notice over the course of the life of your practice too, to begin to recognize the conditions of the mind are not as reactive as they were earlier in practice or before you started practice, for instance. You can see it over the course of a retreat, perhaps, that, you know, you see somebody do something and it's just like, phew, doesn't bother you. And, you know, 3 days ago, it was like creating all this impatience and frustration. So this is the non-arising that's been cultivated through the course of practice. More directly, in a moment, you know, we might think avoiding an unwholesome state that has not arisen. You know, we might find ourselves, getting impatient in the lunch line or something. And so, okay, how do I avoid getting impatient in the lunch line? You might think it on the surface of this, I should wait until everybody's gone through so I don't have to wait in the lunch line. And that way I can avoid that impatience. That's one way to avoid the impatience, but it's kind of doing a little bit of a bypass. So another exploration around this is to, so this, this a practice around this might be to look at what happens when you stand in the lunch line. So rather than avoiding the situation, to be curious about what goes on there. And perhaps if you are a little more mindful in that situation, noticing how you are, you might notice the beginning of a little impatience and then it could pass. Or you might just notice that being more present in the lunch line, being aware of standing and seeing, that creates the conditions for impatience to not arise. Because impatience often arises because we're not being fully present. So it's useful to notice where we get triggered, where our minds kind of move into these situations. Not so that we can necessarily avoid them by not going into those situations, but by bringing our mindfulness with us into those situations. Sometimes that itself will create the conditions for the non-arising of that unwholesome state. And if it does arise, then we can do the next one, the next practice, the effort to abandon unwholesome states that have arisen. So the word abandon, I think often we think of that as something we do. It sounds like an activity that we're supposed to do. I'm supposed to let go. I'm supposed to do this. My understanding of abandoning, I mean, there can be ways that it's active. There can be ways that we can see something as being really sticky, being pulled into a state. For myself, in my early years, really looking at anger, you know, I would see I'd get pulled into the rabbit hole of anger very quickly, trying to be mindful of it. And so I would notice that pull, and I would just kind of acknowledge that pull, acknowledge the pull towards anger, and just, you know, like bow to it. I see you, and yeah, I can't pay attention to you right now. So I'm going to let you be, you know, you can kind of take a walk with me, but I'm not going to put my attention on you. And so there's a way of abandoning that's not giving attention to. It doesn't necessarily mean that it goes away. It's not a repressing. It's not a suppressing, but it's redirecting the attention. And that can be very skillful at times. When especially it feels like we're being sucked into an unwholesome state, we need to take some action. If it feels like mindfulness can't meet the experience, we need to take some action. Turn towards something else. Often something neutral can be really useful in that time. For myself, I found often walking was really helpful. Going to opening to the experience of hearing. Sometimes the breath can be helpful, but often if there's a reactive emotion, a strongly reactive emotion, the breath can be kind of tied up in it. And so if there's a lot of reactivity going on and you try to turn to the breath, you might kind of just be reminded about the reactivity because the breath can be engaged with it. So sometimes it's helpful to have a little bit of a broader experience, a kind of an opening to something more spacious like hearing or taking a walk or being out in nature to support the mind to be able to kind of decouple, kind of demagnetize from something that's so sticky. But that is useful. That's wise effort when we see something so sticky that trying to be mindful of it just takes us into it. That's not a useful exploration. But much of the time, we have more capacity than we give ourselves credit for to actually meet our challenging mind states, those unwholesome mind states. And so this is also a way to explore abandoning. It doesn't on the surface of it seem like abandoning to meet a challenging state of mind. It's like abandoning would mean it would go away. But what I'd say here is that we're abandoning the, we could say we're abandoning the faith in that mind state, perhaps. You know, there's a way in which when we're kind of in it, as Gil mentioned yesterday, you know, it's like when our mind just gets pulled into those difficult states, it's like we're putting our faith in those states. Like that's where the faith is going. Some part of us believes that's going to help me. And so we are decoupling, we are abandoning that faith through an exploration of being with the experience, not being pulled into it. So neither repressing it nor buying into it. There's this middle way of opening to those challenging mind states. In a more, you know, modern day analogy, I think of those difficult mind states, anger, ill will, greed, all of those, that list, kind of being like, well, there's energy to them. There's a kind of a momentum to them. It's kind of like the gears in a car, you know, the momentum of the mind state just kind of hooks into beliefs and views, and they churn with each other. And what mindfulness can do in this kind of a situation is to now put the gears into neutral. So it disengages the gears. And what happens in a car when we disengage the gears still spin. It's not that they stop, but they will stop because there's no longer any energy being put into them. So that's a kind of an abandoning of the engagement with. When we bring mindfulness to our difficult states of mind, our reactive states of mind, these unwholesome states of mind, it can be like putting our mind into neutral. We still see the habit or the pattern. We get to learn about it. And it will ultimately, slowly, I mean, you know, think about how a car works. If you're going 100 miles an hour, put the car into neutral, it's not going to come to a stop very quickly, you know, when you put it into neutral. But you've got the opportunity now to steer the car as it slows down slowly. It's kind of similar with being mindful. So we're abandoning the engagement. And then the wisdom that is developed, the seeing of that in that moment, that's doing that practice that's described in that sutta, understanding those states of mind. As the mindfulness and the wisdom kind of touch into and feel anger, confusion, covetousness, greed, hatred, avarice, we feel the suffering of it. It's not a mistake to feel the suffering of it, because that is how our mind begins to learn. This is suffering. This is not helpful. Our mind begins, the wisdom in there begins to help the mind to let go of it, to abandon it. This is so much of how our practice works. The willingness to meet a challenging experience. and allow the wisdom to grow, the wisdom does the abandoning. And on the wholesome side, we also cultivate the wholesome. Effort to arouse wholesome states of mind, to cultivate the wholesome that has not yet arisen. So again, the precepts are support here, because avoiding situations that oppose wholesome qualities of mind helps to cultivate the wholesome qualities of mind. All of those precepts are paired with wholesome qualities that are kind of cultivated as we engage with them. Refraining from harming cultivates compassion. We may not feel it directly in the moment, but it does create those conditions for compassion to begin to arise as we avoid harming. We also can actively cultivate wholesome qualities of mind by engaging in practices that cultivate them. One of the ones we often think of first there is the practice of metta, cultivating the quality of a loving heart through the active practice of directing our attention towards wishing well. And that begins to aim the heart in the direction of the wholesome. But also mindfulness. Just the practice of mindfulness. One of my teachers, Sayadaw Upandita, used to say, mindfulness is the most wholesome mind state. And so that cultivation of mindfulness, as we cultivate mindfulness, it's got this quality. It embeds the four right efforts, actually, because as we attend to wholesome states, it creates the conditions for wholesome states to arise more frequently. As we attend to unwholesome states, it creates the condition for those to let go. And so the cultivation of mindfulness itself is one of the key ways to support the cultivation of wholesome states. That's a lot of what we're doing here, too. Cultivating the wholesome qualities by cultivating mindfulness. And the practice that we're doing is also cultivating these other faculties, which are all wholesome qualities. So we're cultivating faith by engaging. We're cultivating skillful energy. We're cultivating skillful mindfulness and concentration and wisdom. All of these are wholesome qualities. Engaging in this practice, they begin to come along for the ride. So this practice itself is an engagement with the cultivation of the wholesome. We're doing this. And then the effort to sustain wholesome states that have arisen. This one actually was a surprise for me, because I was like, well, why would I need to work at that? But in my own exploration of my own wholesome mind states, I began to see I dismissed them sometimes. Oh yeah, pretty calm right now. I feel pretty happy. Where's that thing I need to do? How do I fix these other things? Just immediately redirecting to my habit of mind to do and fix and change, as opposed to actually taking in, oh, this is what happiness feels like. This is what ease and peace feel like. So this is another really useful encouragement in our practice. When we notice ease in the mind, when we notice peace and joy, delight, metta, pay attention to them. This is one of the key ways to sustain them, to maintain them. Mindfulness will sustain wholesome states when they're noticed. And notice if you have that tendency, like I had, to almost just Like, oh yeah, that's there. Let me come back to something else. It's like, I remember at one point, it's like, oh yeah, the mind is really calm and settled. Oh, this is probably the perfect time for me to pay attention to that pain in my back. You know, just orienting towards something unpleasant, because that was my pattern, my habit. Instead of really taking in that experience of ease and settledness and concentration, it's like, what can I do with this? Recognize, appreciate them when they arise. So really, these four wise efforts are happening while we're doing mindfulness practice. I just mentioned that, but I'll give another example around cultivating how these four wise efforts can be cultivated as we're looking at something like ill will, aversion. So as we are mindful of ill will, when it's arising, that is that disengagement we're talking about. So it supports the weakening, the kind of slow letting go, the abandoning of it. It also tends to support, as we pay attention to it, as we notice it, we notice the ill will, how it feels, we notice that it's suffering. It tends to create the conditions for the mind to not want to go there in the future, for the mind to avoid, to abstain from it, to just kind of, I remember at one point, to really see how, after having spent a few months really looking at the anger that I was experiencing, seeing the mind kind of heading there, seeing the mind kind of aiming in that direction, the mind just let it go because the experience in the mind was, that way lies suffering. You know, don't go there. And I didn't have to do that. That was wisdom. It was the experience that the mind just didn't pick it up, basically. It wasn't even a letting go of anger, because anger hadn't arisen. It was just seeing the mind getting ready to go there and realizing, yeah, I don't think so. So it was the non-arising of that anger, which was a result of several months of having experienced how much suffering anger created. So that practice right in the moment supports the future non-arising of anger. And right in the moment of attending to a challenging mind state with mindfulness, we are cultivating faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. We're cultivating patience. We're cultivating a friendliness to ourselves, a kind of a metta attitude to ourselves. We're cultivating interest. We're cultivating joy, delight. It's quite amazing how the mind can have those qualities even as it's looking at something as painful as anger. Like, oh yeah, this is helpful. And the joy that arises because of the practice. So this is the cultivation and development, the development and the maintaining of wholesome states. And so sometimes people ask, you know, am I supposed to do mindfulness or am I supposed to do wise effort? If you're doing mindfulness, if you're attending to experience, just even in the simple way of just what's here, just a simple, this is what I'm knowing in this moment, you are engaging the four wise efforts. You don't have to think about it so much. It's just a part of how we do this practice. And so this engagement creates energy. This effort towards the practice creates energy. And how we make energy in the practice is also an important piece. balancing the energy. Some of you mentioned this today, you know, the kind of the analogy of the lute. You know, if the string is too tight, it's going to snap. If it's too loose, it's not going to make beautiful music. It needs to just be right, just the right tension on the string for it to make beautiful music. And so that balance between too tight and too loose, the energy, it's easy to have the energy be on one side or the other. And so there's a little bit of a exploration there. Sometimes too tight, sometimes too loose. Some things that help us notice when we're a little out of balance, if the energy is too tight, if we're making too much energy, it can often create a condition of a kind of a restlessness in the mind. If these energies too loose, not engaging enough, it can often create the conditions for a dullness or a kind of a sloth and torpor experience. Those can be some signals, not always the reasons for those, but if there is a lot of restlessness, it's often useful to balance it with a little bit of calming energy. And if it's a little bit dull and sleepy, it can be useful to bring in a little bit of more purposeful energy. And yet, this way of making effort, it's not so much about when we think of making a lot of effort in our lives, I think we think about doing a lot of things at once. So, you know, making a lot of effort to pick up something heavy. We gather our strength and we're going to do something really effortful. The effort and the practice is much more light, as I mentioned in the instructions, I think, yesterday morning. The light, light touch. The effort that we make in practice is more about how frequently we make a light touch of effort, not about how much effort we think about picking up in a moment. Just a light touch. If the mind is feeling a little bit sleepy, maybe a light touch of effort, a little bit more. And just reminding yourself, it's more about the frequency of reminding yourself, can I meet this? What's here? What's this experience? In breath, out breath, frequency of connecting with experience, every half a breath. Just, you know, that frequency. But then as the mind gets a little more settled, as the mind is more able to stay connected, that frequency can actually be agitating. We're making too much effort for what the mind, the space the mind is in. And so backing off of the effort, maybe every two or three breaths, just, you know, remember connecting. It's kind of like we can connect. There's a connecting and a sustaining, and the sustaining feels like we're just riding a little bit. There's an analogy I like to use around this kind of making effort. It's there are scooters, these razor scooters, I think they're called, that kids ride, not motor scooters. I see kids riding motor scooters now, but these are ones that have no motor. It's just got this little platform that you stand on pretty low on the ground, and you have to put your foot down and tap on the ground to get the scooter going. And when you start to get the energy, the momentum of the scooter, you have to tap pretty frequently. So you tap, 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 but you get the momentum going with the light taps. Now, you could put your foot down and push really hard, but that's probably going to create a pretty unstable ride. So the light taps give you a chance to be balanced, get your balance, get some momentum, and then you can ride for a while. And at some point, the momentum will begin to wane. It'll get a little wobbly, and you'll notice that it's getting wobbly. And so you put your foot down again and maybe tap, and then ride, and then gets a little wobbly, and then tap. And then ride. So you get familiar with that sense of how often to make that tap, the scooter. tap on the scooter. Similar with the mindfulness, that we begin to get familiar with a kind of a sense of the riding the wave of mindfulness. At first, we need to remind ourselves pretty frequently, in, out, rising, falling, stepping, stepping, stepping. But over time, it might be that you just feel into the experience more than you need to kind of be aiming at the experience. You get familiar with that sense of mindfulness having some momentum. And then perhaps a sense of when it gets a little wobbly. Need to connect, need to like re-engage a little bit. So the light touch of effort is just so important. And then getting familiar with how frequently to make that light touch of effort. Sometimes if I was in a real striving mode, like the mind felt like it was really on board, I'm doing this, I would ask myself the question, okay, can I not try so hard? You know, how little work do I need to make? How little effort can I make in order to be mindful? And I often found I could let go of a lot. And oh, still mindful. Okay, how about if I let go a little more? Yep, still aware. And then let go a little more and whoop, mind is off. Okay, maybe a little more effort than that. So sometimes that exploration, if you tend to be a striver, that can be useful to see what does it mean to back off of the effort. If you tend to be on the other side, you know, what does it mean to be a little bit more connected? What does it mean to remind yourself a little more frequently? In formal practice, that might be every half breath or every step, every, you know, couple of steps. Just can I be mindful until I get to that spot on the floor, 2 feet away? Can I be mindful until I get to that spot on the floor? Just kind of pulling myself along that way. So over time, making effort, this natural kind of an energy begins to arise, a sense of, and it's because it's been cultivated in a skillful way, that energy is naturally directed towards the practice. And it starts to feel like, as the energy gains momentum, it starts to feel like the practice is doing itself at times, sometimes. And we like that. You know, it feels pretty good when we don't have to work to do the practice. There's still energy going. You know, the energy is happening. It's just, it's been cultivated. So it's maintaining, it's sustaining itself. And we have to also have, you know, recognize when that's happening. We can appreciate it, recognize the sense of the Dharma energy, the Dharma is guiding us, not having to work so hard. But then, you know, it changes. And we do have to bring that, yep, I need to actually remember to be mindful again. And notice when there's resistance to that, because there probably will be after a period of time when you felt that momentum. It's like, oh, I figured it out. I'm never going to have to make effort again. It doesn't quite work that way. But you get a taste. You get a taste of that, what it means for that effort to have a momentum. So this energy directed towards the practice creates the conditions for this abandoning. It is the kind of engine or the whole way that our practice unfolds. So make the effort. And Let the practice do you. The process of wisdom, mindfulness, energy, concentration, it ripens us. And we don't get to do the ripening, but we get to experience it. So allowing that process through the engagement, connection. So thank you for listening to the Dharma. And may your mindfulness support these skillful efforts. Thank you.